you know, talking about Sabine, I was very fortunate in going through this university from being hired by Paul Dressel, as I told you. And Paul Dressel said to me when he hired me, I'll never pay you less than I pay a man if you do your job. And I only had one boss who finally admitted that one year he did not give me the same raise as he gave the men because they were married. And he said that to me, but I never knew it for a long time. But after that, I have always been so fortunate of having people who were willing to kind of take me under their wings and help me work my way through the university. And Sabine was one of them. He demanded a lot of you, and but you also, he also wanted to do your best for him, you know, because he's a very bright man, and as I said, very creative man. I was also chairperson of the steering committee of the university. I was the first woman to chair the steering committee of the university when Dr. Wharton was president at that time, and I was also chair of the academic senate. But I also know that there were people in the background who were pushing me to be chair, and one of the man who was most responsible told me, and I won't name names because I don't, he said, I asked Dr. Wharton, would he mind if you were chair? And Dr. Wharton said, no, it didn't make a difference to me. So I've always been very fortunate of having people who do. Dr. Wharton is also the one who appointed me to the athletic council, but I'll talk about that in a minute. Now let me go into the major area that is really, you know, all of it's important. It was in 1963 that a group of, and I'll have to look here, of principals in Detroit contacted Michigan State University and Gordon Sabine, and Bill Finney was director of admissions at that time. He's dead now. And said that would you be interested in coming to Detroit, and Mr. Sabine, let me back up. Mr. Sabine had contacted, Bill Finney, director of admissions, had contacted these 11 principals, and they got to talking about students who should be in the university but didn't quite cut the mustard. And Dr. Hanna was on the Civil Rights Commission at that time, as you well know. And so Dr. Hanna and Gordon Sabine decided that what Michigan State should do is to set up a program for students who were not readily admissible to university. So Mr. Finney and Mr. Sabine talked to the principals from the 11 schools in Detroit, and they came up, six principals in Detroit, came up with a group of 25 men, of 11 white and 11 black, and three of them decided they did not want to come, okay? So they brought in 22 men, and they called that Project Ethel. And the reason they called it Project Ethel was, Gordon Sabine thought, that the Ethel Corporation would give us money to run the program. Ethel Corporation never gave us a crying dime. But so the admissions office admitted 22 men, 11 men, 11 white. And we brought them on campus. Now, these students were not the real low-end kids. They were very, very poor students, but had good potential. But they just weren't quite up to the level. We were not out to bring in anybody who did not have a chance of succeeding. And that's one of the things that about running programs for disadvantaged students that we always tried to be very careful of, is to bring in only those that we felt that had a chance for success. We could have gone out and got a lot of kids who would have come in here and bummed out, but I just couldn't stand that, because that failure is very difficult to do. So we brought these 11 kids in here. I was the mentor here again, and whatever, for these 11 kids. Some of them came out of home, one of them came out of a home where it was a dirt floor. And they had never eaten off of a tablecloth, for example. So Sabine, bless his heart, paid for us to have dinner at Kellogg so we could teach them how to use a fork and have a tablecloth and eat and this kind of thing with it. And I worked with those from 1963. I ran groups. Nobody knew really they get in classes and they didn't know about. There was some noise about Project Ethel, but not a whole lot on campus here. Mm-hmm. It was kind of an internal thing that we knew that we were doing. And I had to say so at that time of if there was a problem, I could go in any dean's office. All I had to do was to call and say, I got a problem, would you help me out with this kid or somebody else? And I never had a dean on this campus turn me down. Mm-hmm. And here again, that was the flexibility and the willingness to cooperate. Now, and I ran groups for them, and I learned a lot about myself in the process, and the kids learned a lot about this. And then we began to find out, we've always had black students at Michigan State. Always, but not large numbers. And so this was the start. Now, in 1967, I went before the Board of Trustees, took one student with me, and when we found out that 40% of those students will graduate on time, that was when the university decided to go into major recruitment of minority students. And that was the beginning of the Detroit Projects. And and I ran those programs. I was still asked to run them. Now, what we did the first year, we had we went into Detroit. And just a minute.
So you were working on this prior to the riots of '67.
Yes. Yeah,
working on it before.
That's right, before, because we had the graduation ceremony 2 days before the riots.
Uh-huh.
Thank God. Mm. We went in and we were recruiting these kids, and we started that in 1967. We started early in 1967, and 66 going in to get these kids, and we came up with the first group was, I can't remember here, first, 66 students. Now let me digress for just a moment here. Michigan State was the first institution in the country to make a coordinated effort of recruiting minority students. Wisconsin started a program 6 weeks after we did, and Mrs. Doyle ran that program. Now, we were in contact with each other, and because of the Southern Education Review Board, who came up here hearing about these programs, and the Southern Education Review Board called Mrs. Doyle and I the grandmothers of the movement. And the major difference between the two programs was that Michigan State decided that what they would do was to recruit in Michigan only. Wisconsin decided they would recruit nationally. And that now, in setting up this program, what we knew was that we had to have counselors, and we had to have, I couldn't do it all myself, and we had to have tutors as we began to set up. So we got these 66 kids, and as I said to you, they was only blacks in this group. We decided only blacks out of Detroit. And we had a graduation ceremony for these six kids, the 66 kids, 2 days before the riots.
Mm-hmm.
And the summer of as recruiting in that summer, what we did was to go down and meet with parents. We'd have the parents come into the schools and we'd talk with the parents, find whatever parents we could find, have some support. So that was the start of a recruitment program on campus. It was called the Detroit Project because it was out of Detroit. Now, also in 1970, we had the Lansing Project, which was set up by money from Hinman Foundation. And to this day, I don't know what Hinman Foundation was or is or anything, except they gave some money. Now, we also got some monies for the other Detroit projects from Rockefeller Foundation and university budget. We required the kids to put in some hours a week. The first year of the program cost us $400,000 to run it. And it was not an inexpensive program. And then also during that time, the Lansing Project, what I decided I wanted to do was to recruit the older students. And so we had mothers in there with children, and we had some older black men, and I only had 13 of those, so I had. And then we also started the Flint Project, because we went into Flint, so each city had a name of their a program. Now, now in getting into the, then so every year we'd get more students, okay? We had 66 the first year. Let's see, how many do we have the second year? I gotta find somebody. I think what we did with something like, maybe we brought in 60 more. Then we went into the major kind of recruitment of them. Now,
Dr. Wharton was here then.
Oh yeah, Dr. Wharton was here then, and it was major.
Mm-hmm.
And we, how do you become a question of how do you recruit in Detroit? Because when we asked for students of this same ilk, and by that I mean who had potential but didn't cut the mustard, we were often told that you've got everybody that we know of. Well, we knew that was not true. So what we did was to send our the first Detroit Project and the second Detroit Project students in to the playgrounds and recruit off of the playgrounds. And then we got involved with the black churches, and the black churches helped us recruit. Then we had a piece of great luck by coming into contact with an outfit called the Volunteer Placement Corps. The Volunteer Placement Corps, and Sabine can tell you more about this than I can, and you can ask him about that, would be one thing you want to ask him about. They were law students who were the good-hearted kind of affirmative active people who wanted to go. So they helped us find students and recruit students. So we recruited off the streets, we recruited out of the churches, we recruited out of the playground, and we took students from the other. Ended up, I think the third project was maybe 220 students. Now in the midst of all of this, I said that we had to have women. See, before the first two projects were Miami men, then they started recruiting women. These kids lived over in Fee Hall, and they called it the Fee Circus. And
they were segregated.
No, they were in there with everybody else. No, they were just putting the residence off. But blacks tend to hang together now, like they did then, and they called it the Fee Circus.
Mm-hmm.
There were white students there, and there was a lot of racism on this campus. Kids would come to me and say, well, I'm the only black in the class, and they always know my name. And if the kids said that they, if anyway were discriminated against, I was always a very forward person. I'd go to the professor and I'd say, look, this kid feels like that he is some discrimination here. What are we going to do about it? And I could do that. As I said, in those days, I was permitted and allowed to do it. I was also allowed again to say how long they would stay here. And if I felt like they couldn't make it, then my job, part of my job, would be to try to find some other place for them, some other school that could take them where it wasn't as difficult. I also had some help. Mine gave me help. I had some counselors helping me to work with these students, because our emphasis was on the counseling program and the tutoring, and this kind of thing was where it was with that. And then we had a program called MEMO, More Education, More Opportunity. And ask Sabine about that, because I can't remember a lot about MEMO, but he would know a lot. He went down to Mississippi, or did he send somebody to Mississippi? Well, I don't remember it, but somebody went to Mississippi to see if we couldn't recruit students. Now, during this time, what we did was to try to get other universities in the state to recruit more black students. We would have meetings where there'd be University of Michigan, and where there'd be Central Michigan, Western Michigan, and bring them in here and say, look, this is what we're doing. You need to get more active with this kind of stuff. And we tried to promote this with Dr. Hanna and Dr. Wharton and Dr. Sabine get more students to being recruited. Now, this really impacted this campus. It truly did. I think it brought to fore about the fact that there was a lot of racism here. We had to do something about it. People became very conscious. We talked about these programs. we faculty would hear about them. They asked, faculty would call and ask me, could they help? And a lot of University College people would come and helped me a lot in those days of working with individual students in their classes where they were there. And the students got very active. It called the Black Student Alliance was here. And it was in the 60s that they began to demand, you know, that we recruit 4,000 or 5,000 students, which we couldn't do, but that was one of their things. But they got very political, and I always felt that was probably a good active force for them. Getting involved with the university and with the system was to be active. It never bothered me. They would have meetings over in the union, and one night I said I was going over, and somebody said, "You don't want to go over there because it's all blacks." I said, "They're not going to do anything to me." I walked in the room, and somebody said, "Hello, Doc." They call me Doc. Mm-hmm. They never call me Dr. Norell or anything. They call me Doc. "Hello, Doc." Went right on ranting and raving about how terrible the university was. But never bothered me, and I would go over at nights to Fee Hall and work with the kids, and if they had any problem at all, one night we had a gal pull a knife on one of her, and I went right over there, and when she saw me, she handed me the knife. But, you know, you had to, I asked Mr. Sabine one time, why did he pick me to do this? And he said, "Well," he said, "you're Southern, and I think you understand something about the blacks." And I hope I did, because my mother always taught me that you treat people with respect, even though they're black. Now, she's very paternalistic, mm-hmm. but I always had to treat them with respect. So I always believe that that's what kids want, some respect. You can like them or not like them. If you respect them, they're going to treat you decently. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of the recruitment for minorities. Now, in 1968 or 69, I can't remember, I knew that a white woman could not run the program anymore. Not that they didn't like me, and that wasn't the issue. I think they liked and I think they respected me, but I know they needed a black. So we brought in a guy by the name of Tom Gunnings to take over the program, and I left. And I left deliberately because I knew if I stayed here that people would come to me, and I did not want to interfere with his running the program. So I took a sabbatical to Boston University, mm-hmm. and went there with it. But I think that probably is the most interesting thing that I did in all of my career, and probably one of the things I'm very proud of the fact that I was part of it for this university. We could not do what we did in some of those days, because they would call it affirmative action. In fact, in those days, before we had the application, one of the old applications to Michigan State had on there, "Are you black?" Mm-hmm. You can do that now. look at what's happened to University of Michigan, mm-hmm. With this kind of thing.
Right now.
Yeah, right now with the affirmative action kinds of thing. There's still racism on campus, but it's much more undercover. In fact, and sometimes right before I retired, I used to think it was worse than it was in the days when I did the heavy recruitment, because what people didn't understand on campus, that there were so many of our white kids who had never been around a black. Mm-hmm. And I would go into the residence halls here again most of the time at night after the kids got through studying and tell them about the blacks. I let the blacks educate me about their lives and what it meant, and this kind of stuff, and what they came from. And they have a whole language of their own, and if they would lapse into something like this, I'd say, "I don't understand you," and then they'd explain it to me. Mm-hmm. So they brought me in, and I would go in, and I went all over the country making speeches about this to people who wanted to know about our programs, about the life and the kind of things that black students expected of them. Nowadays it's so covert, you know. You don't. It's just. It's there, but nobody talks about it. Mm-hmm. Those days we talked about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that was one of the glory. I had the black and the first Project Ethel. I had the black and white students in a group together, mm-hmm. and then they'd yell and cuss each other out and this kind of thing, and then walk out and feel good. You see, but I always believe that that's the way you begin to communicate is by having everybody get together and talk about, you know, whatever it is that they wanted to know. So it's tremendous impact, and it was a very, very, and I probably forgot half the things that I did, I don't know. But that's the kind of the gist of the recruitment of minorities.
You mentioned your mother as having an important influence on you. Did your training or your education prepare you for what you encountered in this project, or what else? Was there anything that you had experienced that made you
no other than going
succeed
up
when others might not have?
Going up into the South and learning. No, I can't say that it did. I got my doctorate was in counseling psych, and I'm a therapist, and I did therapy for years, but therapy never worked with blacks. I only had one successful case of a black woman in therapy, and I don't know. When you counsel them, it was just almost like I was trained Freudian, but you couldn't use any of that in the it was today's issues of what's going on in your own life, and this kind of behavior modification kinds of things, and that was a mode of counseling at one time, with this. My mother was the doctor, lawyer, merchant, and chief for a lot in the black community in the South. I was really kind of raised by a black woman because my mother was poor. My father went off and left us when I was 6 years old, and she had to work. So I don't know what it was about it. I was just me, that's all. I'm not a very good self-analyzer.
So Gordon Sabine knew he had the right person.
Well, I hope he had the right person. He'd probably tell you he had the right person, whether he did or not, anyway. But he can certainly fill in a lot of kinds of things with that, because he was really the dynamo in this.
But you're absolutely right in terms of seeing things the way they are today. Lots of times students and even administrators don't know how we got there, they talk about what went on in the 60s, but they don't realize that there were...
No, not with the blacks.
That were important.
Important it was. See, Mr. Hanna, when Duffy Daugherty came here as a football coach and Biggie Munn came as football coaches, Mr. Hanna said that you recruit blacks, you go south and recruit blacks. And that's what made us have such tremendous football teams in those years, because the Southerners weren't recruiting, you see. You could not go on the campus. And as I told you, I told you when I was teaching, I taught classes with black teachers, and my community didn't like that. And I applied for a job when I was, this was in 19, I graduated in 38, 42, 43, I applied for the job as county superintendent of education because it paid me more money in Arkansas. And the man said, we're not going to hire you because if you do, you would integrate us. So I don't know where I got all of it. It was just the right thing to do, is to work with these kids. And I loved them to death, and I liked them, and I had a great time doing it. It was never a chore to me. I have absolutely wonderful career with this kind of things. And so now, whatever else. At one other thing that we had here on campus, back to University College, we had a learning resource center that I used a lot with the kids because Miss Cherney was so marvelous with these kids. I don't know if you knew Elaine Cherney.
Elaine, yes.
And she was just absolutely great. And so if they had problems in reading or anything like that, the Learning Resources Center was always there to do it. Did you ever know Nell Aull when she was in science?
No.
Well, she was another University College teacher in the natural science. You kind of have people pegged who would talk about and help in the their own areas with this, with this kind of thing. With it, can't think of anything else about that. Now, during the 60s also, we had student riots. I told you about the blacks and the Black Student Alliance. We also had, during those days, the first black student who was head of SMSU. It wasn't called that in those days. It was the student government. And that's how I first, as we start thinking about this, I first started working with them, with black students, before I got into the recruitment and working with them on the programs. And there used to be a tree over in Student Services Building where we'd hang out. We'd sit on the rim and we'd talk with this young man. And so I got, you work with one and the first thing you know, they refer another, and then they refer another. I became known as a good person to go see if they had problems. So that's how I got, and you know, that's also how I got known with working with gays and lesbians on this campus, because of course, as you well know, they would not recognize, but I would work with, somebody came, you know, and I worked with one and worked with another, and first thing you know, I had several of them coming for certain kinds of help.
Yeah, counseling?
For counseling help. Mm-hmm. See, I ran the testing program, but I also did counseling with that. Now, during this time, Mr. Hanna, we always used to say that the sun never sets on dry concrete. You're always pouring concrete on this campus. Mm. And he built the living learning units, and they were really a very unique kind of thing in those early days, because what he did, and as I say he and his group, and it was saying in essence, we're going to have a miniature university in Wilson Hall, you know. It's going to be everything you need is right here, the counseling, the academic advising, everything else is right there. And that's what the living learning units were. And in those days, he put signs up on the front of the residence halls, not paid for by public funds.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because he borrowed money to build the buildings, these big buildings that we now have on here, and you know, still got with that kind of thing. Now, go back to the other thing that I said that brought publicity to the campus. Dr. Wharton, I was not the first, here again, I was not the first woman, a member of the Athletic Council, but people think I was. Ann Harrison was the first woman on the Athletic Council, and she preceded me by 6 months. And I've always made known, but everybody will say, no, Gwen Norrell was the first person, but I wasn't. Dr. Wharton, I can't remember who it was now. Somebody resigned to do something, I don't know. And Dr. Wharton named me to the Athletic Council because he said I knew how to work with minority students. And so, yes, I went on the Athletic Council. It wasn't the minority students I was worried about. It was the way they were treating women. Oh, my goodness gracious. And, well, you know, I was mouthy, and I just didn't put up with all of this. And, you know, with it. And, for example, you know, ticket prices, you know, if you were a single woman, you didn't get any advantage. But if you were a married man, you got some advantages with ticket prices. And so it was things like that you've had to get in, you know, in gear and do right by. And so I also pushed to have a woman named, well, she wasn't named, she didn't call director, but she kind of took charge of the women's sports, and that was Nell Jackson.
Okay.
And she's dead now, too. And she was a black woman who kind of took over and to work with the, and I was on the committee that hired her. I've been on so many committees on the university. I've served on, as I said, the steering committee and committees to make to select Mackey, and you know, first one thing and the other. But we got her in here. Now, she belonged to AIAW, okay, and that was the Association of Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. NCAA was the national organization for men, okay, and Dr. Wharton would send me to meetings where that it was AIAW. And I didn't, you know, in so many ways in athletics, men in the early days treated me better than the women treated me. The women in AIAW were very suspicious of me because I really believed in integration, whether it was black and white, but also integration of women and men in programs. And I would go to meetings with AIAW, and I wouldn't have many people talk to me. And these were all women at that. Well, here again, you can't let those kind of things bother you. You have to move on through. But Wharton was very good about sending me. Well, you know, I never had any trouble with Wharton. Dr. Cofer was Wharton's assistant. Dr. Cofer came in it was the big honcho, Lloyd Cofer, he's dead now, came in to talk about Tom Gunning's running the Detroit project. But Dr. Cofer came into the admissions office to be in charge of all kinds of minority recruiting. And he worked closely, was a friend of mine, worked closely with Dr. Wharton. And so we always had entree to Wharton, and he was very good about sending me places. Okay, all right. So I was on the athletic council. I chaired the athletic council. I was on athletic council, two committees to hire two different athletic directors and football coach. I was on the committee that hired Heathcote. And the story about Heathcote is the fact that he wrote the book, and he says in there, and I did, I called up Heathcote.